I'd now like to open Misty's birthday meeting.
Happy birthday!
Thank you all for coming.
We've all been gathered here today to celebrate Misty's birthday, Tuesday, May 2nd. And since we're here anyway, we're going to talk about land use issues.
Sounds good.
All right. So, my dear colleagues, one of the things that comes up, three of the things that come up over and over when we discuss land use, I notice session after session, are things that I wanted to explore in greater detail today. One is, shouldn't we have something that is more diverse, since we have a great big state? Like when one bill is called regional planning or something, I can't
regional
remember exactly.
Pilot program.
Yeah, so we had the one in Southern Oregon that Governor Kitzhaber kicked off in 2011, and I wanted to have folks come and report about how that went the last time we tried something like that. Another one is counties who, at the time the maps were being created in the 70s and early 80s of which property was zoned what, EFU or rural residential or timberland, there's a very commonly heard assertion that there were miszoned properties because they were in a hurry to finish the maps and got towards the end and just put everything EFU. And I think there's probably some truth to that, it turns out. So I wanted the department to talk about a process that was made available in 2009 from the Big Look Task Force that I refer to as remapping, where counties could go back and clean up their maps and change these miszoned properties. Because if people are saying, I can't do what I want in my property, but it's not really farmland, that's one of the ways to deal with it. The third thing I wanted to talk about was, as we get what people sometimes describe as one-off type bills, they often say, why don't you just go through the local process to deal with these and stop coming to the legislature? And so I think what they mean is the goal exceptions process, where a county can take something, consider it a sort of a unique circumstance, and the applicant can ask for a goal exception. But I want to walk through that step by step and what is involved, because I believe it is harder than some make it out to be. And so I want to understand, what does it mean to apply for a goal exception? If you win from a county commission, who else has to sign off on it? What appeals can be made to it? And some examples of things like maybe abandoned dunes that were done by goal exception, because I usually am pretty sympathetic to doing things in the legislature that appear to be one-offs. Other people are really unhappy when I'm at least in favor of doing that. So at least I want to get to the bottom of the goal exceptions process and how easy is it or not easy is it. And if we need to change things systemically rather than one by one, maybe changing the goal exceptions process is the way to do it, if it's too difficult for people to do. So this is like sacred cow of the land use system 101, but I didn't really want to put that on the sheet. I was going to do topic by topic. Then I forgot to do topic by topic. So all our agenda says is land use issues. So you've got lots of people curious, what in the world is land use issues? So those are the land use issues I wanted to cover, and whatever else the committee would like to ask folks about. Representative Esquivel.
I think it may be worth, it behoove us to talk a little bit about the regional problem solving we did in Southern Oregon, because it's the first one in the state of Oregon. And trust me, it was excruciating painful to go through that process, because the two-year project turned out to be a 12-year project.
See, I think it was the
same. But we did get people to comply. We did get people to cooperate. And what it is, it's a regional approach to planning. It's one municipality against another municipality against another municipality, and having them work in conjunction with one another for a good solid land use, and plus buffer zones and so on and so forth between municipalities. So I think that's worth talking about.
Okay. So we can hit the Southern Oregon regional process, which was the three counties talking, but also the one that involved Medford and Ashland and Jackson County and
every municipality in Jackson County. Some of them dropped out, though, which naturally they would.
Okay, so anyway, that's our plan. Who would like to get us started? Director of the Department of Land Conservation Development, bringing with him Josh, who worked on the Southern Oregon processes, and Rob. Okay. Maybe we want to start with the regional things. Or I brought an overview, and then we can get into specifics.
I think that's what we'll do, if you don't mind. Okay, thank you, Rep. Clem, Vice Chair Springer, members. My name, for the record, is Jim Rude, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. With me is Rob Halliburton, who is the manager of our Community Services Division, essentially all of the regional reps and specialists working on certain parts of the system, and Josh Lee Bombard, who is our Southern Oregon regional representative. And much of what you have asked, Chair Clem, Josh will be able to address because he's worked on it. He worked with Jackson County, with Kelly Matting, for a number of years, and then we stole him away from the county, and he's been our regional rep for, I don't know, 17 or 20 years?
Five and a half.
So at any rate, what I would like to be able to do in terms of the department today is just make a couple of overview remarks, turn it over to Josh to talk about the Southern Oregon Regional Pilot Project, but more broadly, to be a resource to you to answer the questions that you, Chair Clem, have raised and any other members. As far as I'm concerned, we're here for as long as you want us to be here to answer whatever questions you may have, and hopefully we can answer at least some of them. But I do have, I think, probably three overview remarks. One of them is perhaps somewhat controversial, but I believe that the state's land use system is not DLCD's land use system, but is in fact the state of Oregon's system. So when we talk about this, we're not talking about just this agency, although we are obviously the keeper of the system, but we're also talking about agriculture, we're talking about forestry, we're talking about fish and wildlife, we're talking about business development, so Business Oregon, we're talking about infrastructure. That often includes, obviously, ODOT, who is the biggest supplier of infrastructure in the state of Oregon, but also DEQ, because they do wastewater implementation, so they are the ones with federal money. The point being that this is a system that is meant to cover almost all the contingencies of development and conservation, hence our name. The state of Oregon does not have a state environmental impact process. In a former life, I was trying to site a gravel mine in Washington State. And everybody refers to parts of the state of Washington that aren't covered by the growth management system. In Klickitat County, the corporation that I worked for spent $2 million and 2.5 years to site a gravel mine because we had to deal with the state environmental impact system. Oregon does not have such a thing. It is only when the federal government is involved in development that an EIS process comes in. So we can perhaps talk about that more later. The second point, all planning is local. We have now 241 towns. I used to say 242, but we lost one, Damascus. We have 241 towns and 36 counties that do the planning. Of course, they have to meet 19 statewide goals, but all the planning happens in those local offices, and we, where possible, try to provide technical assistance and support to them to do that. And the third thing I want to talk about, or just to state, is that we consciously support regional approaches to planning. And so as I could sit here all day and listen to Rep. Esquivel wax poetic about how beautifully the regional problem-solving process works. But in fact, while he's absolutely correct, it did take 12 years. Josh was there for the last 4 years of it, first working for the county and then for us as we approved it. The point being is that Jackson County now has a 50-year plan for mm-hmm. how it intends to grow. And the city of Medford is going through an urban growth boundary process right now. It's with the county, and it'll come to us whenever the county's done. And they essentially control the process. Obviously, Metro is another example of a regional planning process. We're in discussions with Deschutes County right now about how they can apply RPS to look at non-resource lands, to look at growth in Bend and Redmond. But I think generally you will find that the department is extremely supportive of regional approaches to planning. So with that, I'm going to stop. And Josh, spend a few minutes, if you will, talking about SORP, and then we'll answer, including the issues that you, Chair Clem, raised on goal exceptions processes. We've got a big conversation that we just had with the Coastal Caucus two weeks ago now, on goal exceptions, particularly related to infrastructure along the near shore. And Rob is here to talk about that, so we're here for your questions. Thank you.
Good morning. Josh LeBombard, Southern Oregon, regional representative for the department. So I think to begin, I might lead off with regional problem solving. Representative Escoval brought it up. I think that it is a really good example of a regional framework of planning that a lot of regions would kind of strive to emulate. I don't think they would emulate the amount of time it took the region to get there, but the process was a good one. And Representative Escoval, correct me if I'm wrong, but my impression is that it took as long as it did, 12 years, mostly because it was led off with the concept is we want to have some flexibility from the statewide planning system and do something regionally, but they didn't know exactly what that meant, what they wanted to do. So it took them a long time to kind of lead up to figuring out where they wanted to go, and essentially where they ended was the establishment of urban reserves, so a 50-year supply of land for six cities within Jackson County.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, I just want to make it very clear that this legislative body was part of the problem of why it took so long, because someone in their infinite wisdom made a budget note that DLCDC couldn't participate in the regional problem solving. So we were over here trying to plan something, but by the way, we didn't even know about what we were planning for. We were just trying to plan something, and yet DLCDC was on the other side of the wall, not being participating in the process, so therefore we would come up with an idea, then we'd have to take it to DLCDC, and DLCDC, no, that won't work because of da-da-da. So it cost us about 3 years, I estimate.
Yeah, thank you.
In addition to that, the statute, the regional problem-solving statute, which the region was utilizing, has now been changed to correct some of the problems that they figured out during this process. So it was quite a clunky statute, and they've refined that. So the hope is that this process worked out some of those kinks, so to speak. But essentially, what regional problem solving did was create urban reserves for most of the cities within the greater Bear Creek Valley, so a Southern Oregon, Jackson County region. So a 50-year supply, that's the maximum amount of supply that you can create with urban reserves. So what that's doing is it's helping facilitate these discussions about expanding your urban growth boundaries in the region, and it's helping to facilitate competition in those urban reserves because the people that own the land, essentially are under the mindset that their land may not come in for 50 years. So if they want to get it in during this urban growth boundary amendment process, this 20-year process, they need to basically be selling something to the city and the county to make theirs stand out as far as the other land. So I think that what we're seeing, especially with the Medford Urban Growth Boundary Amendment, is that these people are stepping up and proposing more things than they would ahead of time. So, for instance, they're doing some master planning in the areas ahead of time to show how they're going to be efficient with their land supply and things. So we see it as definitely a success as far as regional planning is concerned for Southern Oregon. So to move on to the regional pilot program, That was something that the counties didn't initiate on their own. That was something that was handed to them. And I only say that because the counties kept reiterating that throughout the process. Is, you know, they basically said that if we would have done this, we would have crafted it slightly differently. So I think that might have held up or maybe changed the outcomes of this project a little bit. But in May of 2012, the governor issued an executive order essentially directing certain state agencies, those state agencies being primarily our department, Department of Agriculture, Water Resources, Fish and Wildlife, and Forestry, to work with Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties on creating or allowing appropriate variation in what lands must be planned and managed as resource land. So essentially an opportunity to create some regional variation in what is considered to be resource land. We drafted a scope of work with them to try to refine that, because that's pretty kind of a big umbrella concept. So the scope included the assessment of lands currently zoned for farm and forest use in order to determine whether there was any land in each county that should be considered for redesignation, whether that means shifting something from agriculture to forest land or to open space, or shifting resource land to non-resource land. It also included the assessment of what we call, oftentimes called mapping errors. You know, those errors that you were speaking to Representative Clem about, you know, that happened at the time of initiation, you know, where there's a big flurry of, you know, workload put on the counties to designate lands. So we hear a lot about that. So that was brought into the conversation and into the scope as well. And then carrying capacity analysis. So looking at, if there are lands out there that should not be considered resource lands but should be considered non-resource lands, can the infrastructure handle that? So there was a carrying capacity analysis to look at that. So after about 3.5 years of working on the project, the counties couldn't come to consensus on their product. And what they chose to do with this project, there are many ways they could have looked at creating regional variation. There's a lot of flexibility built into our planning program already to allow them to do certain things. The things that we all talked about, the county and the state talked about, would be extending or creating new rural residential areas, reducing minimum lot sizes for farm or forest zones, streamlining the process to allow farm dwellings, pre-designating certain areas to allow for forest dwellings. And then there are a variety of other things they could do that would likely require some rule changes, so things that aren't currently allowed. And that's somewhat the direction that the counties wanted to go in. But at the end of the day, what they ended up doing was deciding on taking this opportunity and the funding attached. And that's one thing I didn't point out here, and that's the biggest part of this. You know, a lot of counties want to do this kind of work, the remapping work, or the, you know, a regional think kind of thing, but they don't have the resources to do that. What this executive order did was put forward $350,000 to the three counties to do that work. So that would really created the impetus here. So what I would say at the end of the day is what they proposed to do in looking at redefining for themselves non-resource land, they could do that currently. They just typically, they being the counties in the state, they just typically don't do that because they don't have the resources, the financial resources to do that. So the counties essentially looked at this process as a way to define non-resource land, and at the same time what they were doing is further refining or defining what is resource land, because you have to do both at the same time. And after 3.5 years of working on this, what they stated, so these aren't my words, this is coming from the counties, is that it became clear that the differences in soils, topography, geography, and land use patterns were insurmountable barriers to a single non-resource land zoning definition. So at the end of the day, the practical, the realistic differences between the three counties. And I think we can get into more of the, you know, some of the other underlying things, the staffing issues and things like that, that contributed, but they weren't able to coalesce around an idea. They did do a lot of good work, and I think it's work that either they can take and work on individually in their counties, albeit unfunded now at this point, or that we can take in doing some larger statewide non-resource lands evaluations. And I can get into those details. I didn't know how much time you wanted to spend on this. I can get into some of the concepts if you want, or I'd be happy to just open it up to questions if you guys have questions.
I wouldn't mind hearing some more details, but let's do one question at least. Vice Chair McLean.
Well, my understanding from everything that's been said so far today that regional planning is possible now, and that we actually have regional problem-solving statute that you're indicating, you know, has been tightened up because of this process in Southern Oregon. And one of the things since I've been here that I feel more strongly about today than I did when I got here, and that is we don't need a new law if there's a law in a book that makes it so we can do what we say we want to do. And so I guess I want to hear a little bit more about the problem, you know, the regional problem-solving statute or other regional planning opportunities that are available right now.
Rob, you want me to go on that, or you want to?
You want to start?
Sure, sure. I can start on that. So you're right. Regional problem-solving statute. So one of the things that we did as far as preparing a report to you all, to the legislature, to the governor, and to our commission on this project was to put together some takeaways. One of our takeaways was that we would recommend that future endeavors like this look to the regional problem-solving statute because it provides some good sideboards for a process like this. It really lays out the framework for how you would go about doing this. And the primary thing that a region should do first is define their problem and define it as precisely as they can, because what we've seen through regional problem solving and then also with this project is it took a long time, especially when you're working with three different counties that have different maybe ideologies and thoughts about where they want to go. It's really hard for them to define what it is they want to do regionally. So taking a good hard look at defining a problem statement, as it's called in the regional problem solving statute, is really a key first step. And then after you do that, you define your region. So in this case, the region was defined, I would say, somewhat artificially, where three counties were lumped together in an executive order and given some money to do this work. What our standpoint and our opinion was that you should define your problem and match your region to your problem. Don't just take some artificial jurisdictional boundary or some jurisdictional boundaries and create an artificial region. Create your region based on what the problem is. And then regional problem solving statute also provides the sideboards as far as time is concerned. Because what we saw with regional problem solving and then with this too, the money from that was originally allocated to the 2011-13 biennium was rolled over or reallocated twice. And it was just a lot. There was some floundering, and I think having that the time frames with the ability to extend, but it was very precise extension, I think, of 1 year in the statute. I think that provides some really good sideboards and direction for jurisdictions to do something regional.
And if I may add, Vice Chair McLean, to your question or to the answer, there were two things, I think, in the Southern Oregon project that proved to be difficult. The first was that this money was granted in by the state in May of 2011. Remember where we were. Now, 6 years ago, in terms of the national economy. And if you remember, Josephine County was on the verge of bankruptcy. They did not have a planning director for a good period of time. Simon Hare, one of the commissioners, in fact, served as the planning director for a short period of time because there was nobody else that either they could afford who would take the job. So local competence, and I don't mean
any disrespect to Simon Hare, because he's an extraordinarily talented guy, but he wasn't trained as a planner. And so local capacity was lacking. And so it was the money from the state that allowed them to do some of that work. It's expensive work. The second thing that we encountered in Douglas County was, frankly, perhaps a too aggressive approach. Douglas County wanted to redefine what was forest land and raise the productivity level so that more land qualified as not being productive forestry. And their proposal was to reclassify 80,000 acres?
90 originally, and then it came down.
Yeah, so between 65 and 90,000, depending upon where we were in the process, and convert it to rural residential. And the Department of Forestry had two very large concerns about that. One, changing the definition of what was productive forest land, but probably as important was the notion of putting potentially a bunch of houses out on the urban wildland interface. We've had some pretty devastating fires in Douglas County in the last 5 years. And the Department of Forestry and we agreed that that was probably not something that we wanted to do, which was push more residences out there. So those were a couple of very deep concerns that probably led to a less than satisfactory outcome.
Representative Brock Smith.
And during that time, Director, I was the Association of Oregon Counties District 4 Chair, and that was the synopsis that I got of representing Curry, Coos, Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson. So.
What makes it so expensive? What does the money go to?
So
was it just one time $350 carried over? Did we put more money in?
No more money was
allowed
allocated.
For it to continue to roll.
You know, essentially it's staff time, and for counties like Josephine County, they don't have the technical capabilities. So essentially the way you do this nowadays is you do mapping. So you use geographic information systems, and you essentially put layers on top of each other, and you do some analysis. So you look at, you put a parcel layer down, you layer on top of that forest productivity, agricultural soils. You look at, if there's any wildfire hazard areas, and you do your analysis. And for someone that has the technical capabilities to do that, it doesn't take actually that much time. But when you don't have staff to do that, and you have to hire somebody else to do it, it costs a substantial amount of money, especially if you don't have a substantial budget for a department. Then the other thing too is with any process like this, we advocate for citizen involvement. So there are advisory committees, so you're having the GIS people do that analysis, and then they take that information, they present it to an advisory committee, and all the advisory committees for the three counties were solid. They were made up of representatives from forestry, from agriculture, from private sector, from planning. You've got average citizens in there. So it was a good, diverse group of folks. So you're taking, the staff is kind of going through it incrementally and taking different pieces. We did this, and here's what happened. Can we get some feedback on that? So it's not as simple a process as it could be, but I would argue that oftentimes it's made a lot more challenging than it needs to be.
And so did the executive order, given there was, I don't know if it's a difference of opinion, but there was Douglas County's idea on converting forestry definitions that would allow all this development, and we had at least one or maybe two state agencies who didn't think that was such a good idea. Did the executive order require that the agencies sign off on it versus, hey, here's your regional option. Even if the state doesn't like it, you can do it anyway. Because it wasn't a statute change, it was an executive order, I know it had to work within the existing laws.
So the way that we put it and the way that they put it is it took two to tango. So it needed to work for at least two of the three counties, or else it wasn't a regional approach. So what I would say is it would have been challenging if the if two of the three counties would have coalesced around an idea that the state, the broader state, was completely opposed to. But if two of the counties would have coalesced around an idea maybe that we had some issues with, we probably could have worked through those. You know, in the case of Douglas County wanting to really raise the bar or raise the threshold on what should be considered forest land, that they felt that that worked for them, even though we felt in forestry felt that, you know, it was a substantial amount of land being proposed for something else, and they didn't even get to the analyzing the impacts of that. But because they didn't get there because it didn't work for those other counties. The other county said, well, if you do this and we adopt that same thing, essentially that opens up a whole slew of acreage, you know, in our areas because we have, you know, lower productivity standards, and we that's not where we want to go. So they didn't, there was no two to tango in that regard.
Representative Brockstein.
Well, thank you. And to the forest issue and the, you know, Douglas County, let me back up. What we hear as county commissioners is once you've seen one county, you've seen one county. And that's just the reality across the state. Jackson County is very different than Josephine. Curry is very different than Coos. And so I think what Douglas County wanted to do was be able to expand their, you know, rural residential infrastructure and generate more tax revenue by shifting that from forest land to. The argument to me as far as the urban, you know, the wildland fire interface, you know, really doesn't hold water. And the reason is, yes, we have wildfires. We need to manage our timber better. But you have homes that are rebuilt in Tornado Alley, and they could have another tornado and destroy them. And I would argue that data would show that there's more of a chance that a tornado would destroy those homes over there than a wildfire would destroy the homes that Douglas County wanted to do. So I can understand the cautiousness of how we want to do these things and move forward. But we need to give more latitude to the commissioners that understand their county. That's what they're elected to do, in my opinion.
So if I may respond, Chair Clem, Rep. Brocksmith, I think you've touched on a couple of things that are really critical. But the first one that I want to respond to, I want to get to the whole notion of tax revenue and implications for municipal finance. And that's a much bigger issue, but I do want to bring it up. Your first point, though, about rebuilding, you're quite right. And if you worked out the data, you probably are exactly correct that the chance of a place being taken apart in Texas by a tornado is greater than a house in Douglas County being lost to fire. However, there's a social cost to that as well. When the Department of Forestry or local forest control or fire districts go in, the cost to fight a structure fire is multiples of fighting a fire in open forest. And those costs usually occur to some level of government. And that's the primary issue for forestry. They're struggling with budgets as it is. And it's not that they're not going to spend the money to save a house, but it certainly affects their overall financial position and the state's financial position.
Can I give a specific
comment? Please.
So what we looked at, or what we the data we got from the Department of Forestry, I'm not going to keep looking for it. I think I know it enough. What they said was if there's one home out there in the forest and you add another home, you've increased the firefighting costs of defending that extra home by about $30,000. If you have an area that has 99 homes and you add one home, what that does is add the cost up by about $200. So there's a substantial difference between, you know, adding homes in an area that doesn't have homes currently to an area that already does. So one of the things that came out of this, the Southern Oregon pilot, which I think that we as a department and also the county should keep furthering, is the ability to allow for the clustering of home sites in these areas. Not only does it work well from a wildfire cost standpoint, but it also is good from a habitat standpoint. So it kind of serves both of those roles. So I think that's something that we should move forward with.
Follow up. I can't thank you enough, Mr. Chair, for this conversation. So I'll shift to Curry. I'm a little more familiar. When it comes to land use, we have an issue right now. Well, first off, 1,648 square miles, 67% federally owned, 22% private timber, 7% farm, 1% state, leaves roughly 5% of economically developable land. Mm-hmm. Then you add Highway 101 through it, Goal 18, just one of the 19, of course, and a 59-cent tax base, and you have an economic collapse. There just isn't the land to develop in order to sustain ourselves. And there isn't the land, taxable land, to raise the revenues to fund the services. We have an issue right now with Sebastian Shores, which I know you're familiar with, that is being eroded away by Hunter Creek. And there needs to be new... I forget what they're exactly...
Armor.
There needs to be new armor. The folks are having a difficult discussion about even doing that because of supposed habitat between the ocean and the bridge, which I would argue is slim to none, considering it isn't there half the year. And so these are the type of discussions that I think when we're talking about how the various agencies, because it's not just DLCD, it's ODF&W and Department of State Lands, and the current rules just don't work, and they need to be fixed because we're about ready to lose. They put riprap in because they needed to do so to save their homes, and now they're in violation, and it's just not okay. And so when we look at moving forward, especially with Goal 18 along the entire coast, I know we discussed this at Coastal Caucus as well, being able to armor and then have the vegetation on top is something that needs to happen, and it needs to happen, in my opinion, prior, you know, not just for things prior to 1971.
Is that a good segue into goal
I think
exceptions?
It is. Yeah, that's exactly right. Okay. So,
one sec, Jim.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, Josh, did I understand you correctly when you said we need to cluster these houses? You don't mean in the rural area, do you?
Actually, I do mean primarily on forest land. So currently, statute requires a minimum of an 80-acre lot size. Mm-hmm. So if you have 320 acres and you want to divide that, you create four 80-acre parcels, which it really makes it hard to cluster those dwellings. The concept would be that you would allow three of those four to be size smaller than that, whether it's 5 or 10 acres or whatever, and you allow that last one to be the size that it would take to average it out to 80 acres. So you wouldn't overall reduce the minimum lot size, but you would have one be a larger piece of property, which would in all likelihood probably be managed for resource for timber. It's more likely than if it was broken up into 80 acre pieces, or it'd probably be managed a little bit more efficiently. And those other properties would be clustered to try to reduce the cost of fighting fires and to help habitat and things like that.
Follow up. So you aren't advocating that we do this subdivision type approach out there. You're trying to, because I'll say one word, Niedermeyer.
Right. No, I'm not advocating for creating a bunch of subdivisions out on forest land, but there are opportunities out there currently, division opportunities where you have, you know, large pieces of property, and they are coming into the county to split it up. And if, to the extent that we can help facilitate that type of clustering development, I think that's something, at least from a county standpoint, that we should be continuing that discussion on.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I appreciate it, but even that is difficult, especially, you know, I have ranchers in my district that have, you know, 1,000 acres, and they have kids and families, and they want to split, you know. I mean, we have succession planning that we need to do for our farmers that we just can't and aren't doing. You know, our farmers are aging. Their kids need to be able to move to their property, in my opinion, and be able to build a house next door to mom and dad, not only to take care of them in their elderly years, so that they don't have to go to a home somewhere, but also to learn the trade to keep our farming and ranching families moving forward. And if that doesn't happen, what happens to that farm? The same thing with the timberlands. It's a very difficult process for the Halls up the Sixes River is a perfect example. The man has spent 5 years trying to subdivide his property because he has children and he wants to carve it off. And well, the grandparents had the overall ranch that was put into a trust with the 7 children, and they wanted to divide, you know, the acreage up. But so.
Isn't there a process for a family member who wants to take over a farm to get another dwelling? Is it called family dwelling or something like that?
Relative farm dwelling. Yeah. So I would say that there are opportunities for succession planning to happen currently. I think there's this potential misconception out there that it is really difficult to do those things, and in my experience, it isn't. I think what happens is, or what has happened in the past, is we've created a kind of insurmountable barrier for average people to walk up to a counter in a planning department and ask for things. They're kind of scared before they get there. We need to continue to work toward making that a much easier step for people to take, because those type of opportunities are pretty easy. That it's to, you know, the county should be able to pretty easily tell you what information you need to submit for a relative farm dwelling, for instance. So those opportunities, I do believe, exist. Mm-hmm.
So if I may, Chair Clem, I want to... Rep. Brock Smith has given us 5 hours worth of conversation here that we can go through. I do want to address a couple of things and get to the goal exception issue for Goal 18, because I think it's a good discussion. We started that discussion a couple of weeks ago with Coastal Caucus, and I think there are some things that we can do going forward. But I do want to get back to this notion of municipal finance, because I think you raised an issue that every local government deals with, and that's how to get new revenue, which every city and county in the state needs, and essentially are prohibited not just by land use, but also by our taxation policy. Measures 5 and 50 effectively set a cap on how much taxation and valuation could rise over time. And what they didn't set a cap on was the costs to the community of doing policing and fire and delivery of services, all the other things that counties and cities have to do. If my friend Pete Truax, the mayor of Forest Grove, was here, he could do hours on the problem of so-called compression, where costs are bumping right up against the cap on taxation revenues. And so what local government is forced to do
is to start looking for new developments in order to generate that revenue, because new development isn't capped in the same way that older development is. And I would argue that this body needs to take a very serious look, and I'm sure that you've had local government officials forever telling you that you've got to do something about measures 5 and 50, and start getting some money into local governments so that they are not forced to put up new developments in order to increase the gap in tax base. I would also argue to you that there's probably a fair bit of data that would suggest that if you do a net present value on the cost to serve a property, they far outstrip the revenue generated to local coffers. The problem, of course, is for electeds, that money comes in early, and the costs stretch for 50 years, and you don't think about that kind of stuff when you're doing annual and biennial budgets. So just throwing that out. But I do want to get to goal 18 quickly, and then Vice Chair McLean will get back to your question, if you don't mind. So Rep. Brock-Smith, you bring up one of what I think of as the thorniest issues that the department, but also, frankly, ODOT, any local utility, and the state parks, because state parks runs our coastal strip. I mean, if you remember, if you're my age, not yours, the beach used to be a highway, and it used to be part of the highway department, and then we pulled the parks department out and made them themselves. But they are the ones who are the primary landowners of our beaches. And so it means that ODOT and Parks and DLCD and others need to work together to save what I think of as critical infrastructure along the coast that is in danger. And in some places, we're not allowed to use the phrase climate change, but the fact of the matter is, I think, that the frequency and intensity of storms along the coast are increasing. And I just heard a piece this morning on the radio on the way in. If you chart the number of billion-dollar natural disasters, the number is increasing nationwide this year by 33% year over year. Could be a variation, maybe not. But the point being, sea levels are rising. The effect of ocean storms on shorelands is something that we see all up and down the coast. We need to make a change to Goal 18. No question. ODOT tried to do that before my time, but maybe 8 or 9 years ago. And obviously there are some advocacy organizations along the coast who care very much about our ocean and coastal goals. And apparently the ruckus was so great that ODOT simply abandoned the issue. This is where I make the transition to a goal exception. I think right now we have to, rather than going into the goal language itself and redefining the word development, because right now development only includes housing, we need to have a broader definition of development so that it includes infrastructure. It includes that highway. It includes all of the sewer and water and electricity and everything else that goes along that right-of-way. And we can do it in two ways. We can change the goal. We can change the definition of the word development, which I think is probably the ultimate place we need to land. But in the meantime, we need to do county-by-county exceptions processes. So ODOT can go into the county, whether it's Lincoln, Curry, Coos, or Lane, or wherever, and they have a wonderful set of schematics that look at more protective armoring. And it includes putting in a base foundation of rock and then covering that back over with sand and then working their way up the bank, whether that's with bioengineering or whatever else. And I think that the answer is probably way better than what we're doing right now. The part of the coast that I visit most often is the Central Coast, and anybody who's ever driven south of Cape Foulweather along Beverly Beach knows the roller coaster that Highway 101 currently is. And that is not a long-term sustainable situation. To your individual issue about homeowners, we find ourselves in the situation of needing to balance private property rights and public property rights. And the problem with armoring an individual or a series of individual homes is that it moves the problem, to those places that aren't armored. And it tends to eat away at the beach. So if you drive a little further north, you go up to Neskowin. When I was a kid, there was a beach out there that was hundreds of feet thick, deep. Last time I was there, last fall, maybe 50, maybe 100 feet, depending upon tide, it changes the entire contour of the beach when you do armoring. And so that's the balancing that we have to think about. I've talked enough. Anything else? Rep McLean. Sorry, I'm taking over here.
There's so much to think about. I mean, when you start, talking about all these different things, I really, on the goal exceptions process, I mean, there's always exceptions in life. It seems like, that you have to have a process in place. But I wanted you to talk a little bit more about the exceptions process we have right now. You alluded to the definition of development and talked about it, as far as the coastal area as being, both infrastructure and housing. But as far as the exception process, because, again, it's in place, so if there's something wrong with it, let's fix it. But if there's the ability to use it for things that need to happen, like the representative was talking about, then let's do that instead versus, again, just adding another law to the books. So besides definition, what are some of the other issues with the goal exception process that you've experienced?
Okay. Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. Again, my name is Rob Halliburton. I'm Community Services Division Manager at DLCD. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about process. I wasn't really going to talk about the substance of individual type of individual exceptions too much, but I'll certainly take questions if you have any. So in statute and in a goal, statewide planning goal, there is a provision for taking an exception to a statewide planning goal. Think of it as you might at a local jurisdiction as a variance. It's a way to gain some relief from the requirements of a statewide planning goal. And there, in statute and rules, there's three different avenues, if you will, for taking an exception to a goal. And I'd like to go through each one of those if I have time, just briefly. But before I do that, I wanted to say that an exception, taking an exception, is the lingo that we use, is a plan amendment, and they're usually rural, so it's usually a county dealing with it, and so a county would update its plan. So procedurally, the minimum amount of process that takes is a planning commission hearing and a board of county commissioner hearing, and whatever the time frame is to do that depends largely on how controversial it is locally, I believe. If there isn't a lot of testimony on the item, you can be done in a couple of short hearings and be done in a few weeks once the application is made. But that also begs the question about the application itself. Sometimes the time and expense leading up to the application before you start the public hearings process can be somewhat intense. So I'll talk about the criteria a little bit to explain why that might be. So the first avenue, the first justification for an exception to a goal is if the land is physically developed to a use that's not allowed by the goal. So the goals that we normally see, the most commonly see exceptions to are the farm and forest lands goals 3 and 4, and the urbanization goal 14, at least statewide. On the coast, there might be some variation to that. But statewide, those are the goals that we most commonly see exceptions taken to. So a physically developed exception, if you have a house or a store or a factory out in a rural area on land that might, the soil and other attributes of the land might suggest that it would qualify as farmland, well, it's already physically developed to another use. And so there's a justification there for the county to approve another zone, an appropriate zone, be it residential, commercial, or industrial, whatever that may be. In tandem with that justification for an exception is the irrevocably committed exception. That's where the land itself isn't developed, but because of surrounding development, you can't expect that parcel to be used for uses that are permitted by the goal. So again, using farmland for an example, in areas that were built up in rural residential use before the goals, prior to the enactment of the goals, not every parcel was developed, but the area was so developed that it wasn't reasonably available for farm use anymore. So counties would use combinations of the physically developed and irrevocably committed exceptions to rezone larger areas for rural residential or for whatever the use was. And so most of the existing exception areas that you see out on the landscape now are, that was the justification, developed and committed or irrevocably committed exceptions. Those opportunities still exist in statute and rule, but I would suggest that most of the areas that qualify for those exceptions probably already have an exception on them, already have the appropriate zoning on them, if the property owner wants it to. If the property owner hasn't asked for the exception, they're fine with the existing zoning. There might be lots of parcels out there that would qualify if the property owner wanted it, but they haven't requested it. So in those places where a property owner wants it, there I don't think there's a lot of additional opportunity. So the third avenue for taking an exception is what we euphemistically call a reasons exception. And this one is more wide open. This one provides more flexibility than the other two. I fail to say that we have over 30 years of case law on these, so just reading the rules doesn't necessarily give you the full picture on what the regulations are, that there is lots of case law, LUBA and Court of Appeals especially. And so in the reasons exception, that's, again, more of the release valve for if somebody needs to do something different with their property, or if they have a use that there's a reason why the goal shouldn't apply. And so in order to justify that, it requires an alternatives analysis about, is this a good place to put it? Do you need to look at other places that don't require an exception? Are there other reasonable places inside an urban growth boundary, inside an existing exception area, where your use could go? An applicant is required to identify and analyze those other alternative places in their application. Also, an applicant would need to look at other places that do require an exception, other places in the vicinity, and take a look at the energy, environmental, social consequences of locating on one parcel versus another in an effort to ensure that the impacts of the proposed use are in a place where it can best be accommodated. So these analyses do take time and effort, and because of the case law and the rules and the statutes and everything, it's a legalized process. And so it's typical for an applicant to hire an attorney and for an application to be, you know, several tens of pages thick to justify an exceptions request. So a lot of the discussion, I think, is some people say, well, we'll just go take an exception, like it's an easy thing to do, and somebody else might say it's impossible to get an exception. I would suggest that both of those extremes are probably a little outside of reality, that there are exceptions that get approved every year, that LUBA upholds every year, but at the same time, there's not a lot. In the last 10 years, there have been over 120 exceptions approved around the state, and you know, depending on your point of view, that's not very many or that's a lot. Again, I don't know if that answers a question as to how hard it is. The what we sometimes say is that if you have a good justification, it's easy, and if you don't, well, then it's not that easy. So we do have rules, and I want to make it clear that a reasons exception for additional rural residential development is very constrained, that basically you'd need to show that there's some need for the rural residential use, like a rural job generator that's not close to a workforce, where you need that housing. That's really the only justification for a reasons exception to accommodate rural residential use. But for site-specific commercial or industrial operations, particularly if they're noxious and you don't want them in an urban area, but not entirely that for that reason, there are opportunities for exceptions to the statewide planning goals to accommodate those uses if the proposed place is the good place based on the alternatives analysis. And I would also like to briefly talk about the Goal 14 exception that I talked about. Goal 14 is our urbanization goal, and it's the goal that encourages urban uses inside urban growth boundaries only, that not to try to prevent or discourage urban uses outside urban growth boundaries. And therefore, counties are required to zone rural land such that they're not allowing urban uses. Well, the Goal 14 exception is, just as the name implies, that release valve. If there is a reason why an urban use needs to go into a rural area, and a county has or a property owner has that opportunity to take the exception to Goal 14 and demonstrate through the alternatives analysis why the urban use should be permitted on rural land. So again, the procedural part of it and the cost aspect, I wouldn't say is insignificant. It's not, and it depends, and it's variable depending on the sensitivity of the application.
So let's walk through just a little further on just an exception. So someone gets their 10 to 20, gets their lawyer, gets their 10 to 20 pages, goes down, asks the county planning department for a reasons exception, and then they say, here's what's going to happen from here on out. We have our commission review it, or how does it work, and who has to sign off on it?
Okay, so the application would go to the county, and the county would schedule a hearing with the planning commission, who would hold one or as many hearings as they needed to make a decision, which would be a recommendation to the Board of County Commissioners, because plans are adopted and amended by the elected body. And so it depends on the local process and as to how long that actually takes. There is a 120-day rule for permits. A county is required to make a permit decision within 120 days. A plan amendment is not subject to that statute, so the process certainly can and often does take longer than 120 days. And especially if there's objections and the applicant generates additional materials to justify the request, and there are continuances and things, the process can linger. But it's at that local level, and then it ultimately is decided by the Board of County Commissioners, which is appealable to LUBA.
So does the LCDC have to sign off on exceptions, or
no,
review them, or anything?
We receive notice just as a neighboring property owner would,
yeah.
And so we have the opportunity to participate, but we don't have any special rights or responsibilities.
So LUBA is the place where if people are unhappy with the county commission's decision to grant a reason exceptions, they go to LUBA. On what kinds of grounds can they appeal? Just that they don't like it, or that there was flaws in the analysis or something like that?
There are criteria that I briefly talked about in a very general way, but there are criteria on each of the different types of exceptions. And so in order for an appeal to be successful, they would need to show either that there wasn't adequate evidence to show the criteria were satisfied, or that that's the most common reason why an application fails is lack of evidence. But it's possible that that LUBA finds the county construed the evidence wrong.
Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the appeals process, because we've been through a few of these as a commissioner as well, and what I'm used to in the past is there's an appeal at every possible process from folks that don't live 300 miles or 250 miles from the project, and they come in at 4:55 on Friday of the deadline, and everything in the kitchen sink is thrown at it. Now, when you have a planning department that only has three total people in the building and planning department, there isn't the resources to deal with this. It costs an upwards of, for permitted use on projects, an upwards of $500,000, which then just stifles any future development because they just look at it, oh, no, I don't even want to go there. Because they're because the process is so cumbersome in the first place, and it's costly that they have to spend, you know, an upwards of $1 million before they can even turn a shovel.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the cost for sending it to LUBA? Because I think we kind of hit on it here. When you told us about LUBA. You said to be successful. Well, that doesn't mean anything to some people. The only thing they do is tie you up.
Yep.
Was it $200, $250, or $500, or whatever it is? And they could live in a different state, isn't that correct? Have no standing at all.
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, participant is required to participate at the local level in order to have standing to appeal, but there is not a residency requirement in order to participate at the local hearing.
Follow up. So in other words, they could send in a letter to the record.
Yep. Conceivably, yes. Yes.
Like, I'll give you an example. The reason I want to talk about this is because I do hear somewhat regularly, mm-hmm. you know, send people to the exceptions process. Don't consider bills at the legislature. Let's just take one. It was the Young Life Camp. This was a former Rajneeshi complex that I don't even know if they got permits when they built everything, but they had ruined, an area already with development. Let's just put it that way. Or they had already built an area. Outside of the city of Antelope, they made their own little commune. So then Mr. Washington goes in, buys it, donates it to Young Life, and they turn a bunch of dilapidated apartments and things into really a pretty splendid place for youth to be able to get out of town. That's the point, I think, is to get them out into the countryside and see nature a little bit. So then they came to the legislature in like 2011 or something like that and said, hey, we've got an offer to receive another, I think, $70 million to build another couple buildings right near where the other ones are, but we want to add on a couple more buildings so we can have more youth come to our camps. And there were people who said that you should go to the exceptions process. Don't do a bill. But the county commissioners of that county were telling me, as the chair, that we will never get through it and we're going to lose the donation and that's impossible. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time knowing whether that's true or histrionics. I don't know. So we did a bill that was not a one-off. It said youth camps can be not just on forest lands but can also be on ag lands. By the time the rules were done, I think they got permission and it was cited, and so I don't know if there's as many objections, but I do remember some people at the time who didn't like the broad reach because it wasn't just for Antelope, it was for the whole state, I think, and there were people then who said, God, I wish you had done it one-off, because now they're open all over the place, which you can't have it both ways. That's one of my frustrations. And so that one, the county said there's no way we think we could actually defend this, but I don't know if that's valid, and I don't know why it would have been so problematic. Or maybe they could have, it was just extraordinarily expensive and they were going to lose the donation and they would rather have the legislature involve themselves.
Well, if I may, Chair Clem, I can start and Rob can finish, because we did actually do rulemaking. Yes. That allowed that to move forward. And my memory is that rulemaking was, I don't know, 6 or 7 months. And yes, in fact, they are there and operating. At the outset, one of the issues was that the property straddled two different counties. Mm-hmm. And it sort of goes back to what both Rep. Brock Smith said and what Josh said. If you've seen one county, or if you've visited one county, you've visited one county. And in this case, I think it was, it was Wasco and Jefferson, and I don't remember which of the two counties said exactly what you said, it'll never make it through the process. My sense is it was Jefferson, but I don't know that for sure. And because it straddled those two counties, and because one county simply was not prepared to take it on, it had two ways of going. And the way that everybody chose, obviously, is, as you said, was the one-off with rulemaking with the department. We had a rules advisory committee, which consisted of neighbors and interested parties. And I think, frankly, the rulemaking went fairly well. But that's not to say that it didn't take time, because it did.
And if we had went the reasons exception route, then it would have been what you described. They apply to both counties, potentially do their work, get the counties to agree, and then face some unknowns at the LUBA level based on if they made errors along the way.
So another example by the same sponsor, we're in the middle of a conversation right now with the city of Madras, and bringing some land into the urban growth boundary, including the airport. We've given the city a range of options for doing it, but they're choosing to go the legislative route because, again, the city of Madras and the county of Jefferson do not see eye to eye on this issue. We propose some mediation between the city and the county, but in this case, the city wants to go ahead with legislation, and that's probably what's going to happen. We have layers of government in Oregon. One layer is hesitant to interfere in the business of the other, and sometimes it causes problems.
Well, first of all, I really appreciate that Chair Clem is trying to have this conversation about one-offs versus, you know, a general application, because I've given him a bad time about one-offs that he does on a regular basis. I'm even voting on a one-off, because there are times where there has been a bad law made or a one-off made that made a law worse, and so then we end up having a situation where we have to actually look for fairness to the property owner. I get that.
And I appreciate it.
But the one thing that is really, you know, bothersome to me. We have an exception process. It's not supposed to be easy. Otherwise, it would be just part of the regular rule. And so, you know, I think there are some reasons why we have some pretty stiff, you know, sideboards, if you want to call them that, or criteria to make sure that we're actually following the goal that we actually said was important to us. So I think that's important. It's balancing that goal that we want to achieve with an exception that truly is an exception and not something that just seems to be part of, you know, of the overall analysis for this one particular area. And so I have to balance all that in my head. But the one thing that you folks were talking about that I thought was interesting, and that is there's always an opportunity to review process, and there's always an opportunity to review if there is a series of things that happens over and over again, then that means that that's the problem. So either we go to the regional, you know, problem-solving, you know, statute to figure that out, or we try, and that's where the city and the county are agreeing on something, or a couple of cities and two counties, or however many, or we figure out what it is that we need to do that's going to help in a general application statewide because it's realistic. Now, you guys have a little pilot project out there that I would love to have you update us on. We probably don't have time today, but it's the affordable housing 50-acre pilot project. And it's where, again, we tried this little project to talk about affordable housing wherever it's needed, and maybe we need to put it outside UGBs. And we have the idea of infrastructure costs. We have the idea of the filters of things like, you know, fire danger. We have all of this stuff. And so I guess, you know, you could use that as an example of, is it been hard to cite? Because there are issues that we have to deal with that really are applicable or should be applicable statewide, whether it be affordable housing or anything else.
Oh, I don't. Let's sure. have you come back and talk about that in more detail.
I can do this in 2 minutes.
Okay.
because I think that, Vice Chair McLean, you've raised two very important issues. So we spent 4+ years working to streamline the urban growth boundary process. It came to this body 3 years ago, and it passed unanimously in both houses. And so we took a deep dive and a structural change to the urban growth boundary process to make it simpler and easier
and
faster.
That's for the 2254
correct.
Non-metro UGB. Yes.
Absolutely yes. correct. And at yes. the same time, the department, through state funds, assumed the cost of doing population forecasting.
Right.
And so we give updated forecasts to every city and county every 4 years. Mm-hmm. And that's a cost that is no longer borne by individual jurisdiction. And because it is now state law, it is not appealable as a land use decision. So that's point one. Point two is, yes, there is an argument about the cost of delivering a unit of affordable housing. And many people claim that it is because of the land use system driving up the cost of land inside the UGB that makes affordability so difficult to achieve. So we are doing this pilot to test that theory. In fact, we're doing an analysis of the cost drivers to deliver a unit of housing, whether it's land, whether it's services, the cost of money, the cost of labor, the cost of compliance, or frankly, the cost of simply waiting, that is the time value of money while you're waiting for permits to be issued. And so we're looking at all of those things. We have a pilot that allows a city of fewer than 25,000 people to submit an application to us due by the 5th of September, and we're willing to help and guide in any way we can local governments to do that. There is a second community of more than 25,000 people. It's 50 acres. It needs to be committed to affordability for 50 years, and we're testing the theory.
Okay. Sounds good.
So one other question I have, just talking about, since we have the bill on the floor today, actually, I'm trying to remember whether you can use a reason exceptions on anything you want. For example, on this bill that we've got about the golf course in Southern Oregon, it is the definition of high-value farmland that's catching that particular 27 acres up in the situation they found themselves in was they have an approved golf course. They have 27 acres that was not eligible under state law for further expansion of the golf course onto it, because in 2011 we passed a law saying no golf courses on high-value farmland. So when they went to the definition of high-value farmland, it talked about water permits that had been applied for as of a certain date in 2007, and this one had one, which had since been not perfected, willing to be withdrawn, but it was still caught up in the definition. Could a county even take an exception to the definition of high-value farmland?
Chair Clem, a county could take an exception to Goal 3 for a use not permitted by the goal. I don't know the facts in this case, so I don't know what advice the property owner was getting at the counter in the county as to the prospects of success, but that is a use that a property owner could seek and potentially get an exception to Goal 3 for.
But can you take an exception to a statute? Because this is a statute that was written for Measure 49, and I don't think a county can take an exception to a statute.
They can't take an exception to a statute, but that statute only applies in an exclusive farm use zone.
If the county rezoned the property to
a different zone, then that statute wouldn't apply. But in order to rezone the property, they would need to take an exception to Goal 3.
I see. So get the zone changed so then it's not...
But then it isn't
EFU anymore.
But then it wouldn't be eligible. Sorry, Mr. Chair. But then it wouldn't be a permitted use for a golf course.
Well,
if
they put it in a zone that allowed golf courses, then it would be. But I don't.
Definitely not within an urban growth boundary, and I don't know where all golf courses can go. They can go on EFU, but they can't go on high value farmland.
Correct.
I don't think they can go anywhere else.
It's already built. It would take one or two, not the reason.
Yeah, because we don't have
one or two. Okay, we'll explore this offline so everybody can go.
You said one thing on the exceptions that I wanted to address, if I may. You said that once you get through all the hearings, you don't know whether you're going to get a LUBA appeal, and it's an unknown. I would suggest, I'd like to say that there's a what we call the waive it or raise it law, that in order for somebody to appeal something to LUBA, they have to have raised the issue at the local level first. So the local government does know the issues before they make the decision. Admittedly, sometimes they get dumped at the last minute. But the burden of proof for to show compliance with the rules and goals is on the applicant. So the applicant, even if you don't have very much staff at the local level, it's still the applicant's responsibility to show that the criteria have been satisfied, and it's their opportunity to extend the process in order to give them the opportunity to do that. So I'm not completely disagreeing with you.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But it isn't just a total unknown.
Well, before they start, it's unknown. As they go along,
before they start,
they find out what the objections are going to be.
I'm not saying that it's, and I never did say that it's not the applicant. The problem is the burden, and everything that's thrown at it.
We got to all go.
No resources to deal with it. And literally in an email at 4:55 on a Friday, never shown up for any of the hearings, never shown up for any of the meetings. And then it went to, in this instance, it went to LUBA twice.
I'm certainly not defending that practice.
I understand. And then they would fight use of the in a different, separate manner, but the use of the treated effluent.
That's my daughter's video game. Sorry, it's really not mine.
To use as irrigation. Anyway, it's I appreciate the conversation and appreciate the chair bringing the conversation to.
Okay, to be continued another time. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, Misty.
Yay, thank you.
And we're out.
Thank you.
And we're out.
Yay.